Hey, Elliot.
Hey, Brian.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we are sitting down with Brian Saliba, the creator of Rackham Vale, Dr. Grordboard's scientific adventure violence, and most recently and presciently for this conversation, the Monty Python co-curricular medieval reenactment program. Brian, welcome to the show. So good to have you.
True, thank you. Incredibly pleased to be here. I'm not British at all.
We did have a bit when we were preparing for this conversation where we were like, if this guy's not British, we do have to kind of give him a hard time about just how British this book is. Or maybe it's a compliment, how British we assumed you were in reading this game.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm just your typical guy born in Southeast Alabama, so exactly who you'd expect. dive headlong into a Python RPG.
We would say it was pretty unexpected when we first heard your voice.
Nobody expects the Spanish Inquisition.
It was my one joke I'm going to do, I promise.
Okay.
Killer sting. I love it.
I love it.
Nobody expects a Southern Alabama person to write this game.
So, Brian, we like to, at the top of this, kind of set the table of what we're going to talk about. And today we want to come at Monty Python, this game, from a number of angles, one of which being making a licensed product, another which being making humorous games and helping people find funny at the table. And then if we've got time, we're going to talk a little bit about public domain imagery and how you kind of made use of that. But my first question, if you'll indulge me, is you're making a licensed game. How on earth did you resist the market push to just make it in 5e?
Oh, gosh. You know, it just never felt like an option for this. For the previous game, for Dr. Grordboard's Scientific Adventure Violence, we did do that one in 5e. Part of it was economics. I mean, the IP itself isn't super well known, but we also felt like it, the content lent itself fairly well to that rules chassis, but and it also allowed us to kind of like Python, the Dr. Grordboard's is very satirical, and it allowed us to subvert some 5e tropes, which was kind of fun. But for Python, it just didn't feel, it felt like it had to be its own thing, which of course is making things 10 times harder than it has to be, opposed to taking an existing rule set, adapting it, which is also extremely hard. I don't mean to downplay that exercise, because that's its own, brings its own difficulties. But, you know, any kind of system that allows for you to gain strength and be harder to kill and gain power as a result of doing things successfully kind of automatically rules it out for Python. You know, that's just the antithesis of Pythonism, you know, that endeavoring toward great achievement is and succeeding is going to benefit you in some way. So that was one thing that immediately called or made it hard to find an existing system that would fit it. In fact, if you try too hard, if you roll too high on a die, we have this mechanic whereby you've taken the whole thing way too seriously and made everybody uncomfortable, and you have to take a demerit from your headline entertainment, right? I mean, it's, if you flub a roll, then you've spammed it and you get a demerit. And anyway, we can get into mechanics if y'all want to later, but this, that on the opposite side of that, there's not a crit, you know, you can't crit and just, oh my gosh, you've done so great. If you do too great, I mean, you know, British people get really uncomfortable with that kind of earnest endeavoring. So you have to, there has to be a penalty for that. So that was one thing. And that's something that was a bit of a concern, and I guess will remain a concern until this is in people's hands and see how they react to it. But that meant that there's not really a lot of like character progression. There's not a leveling up mechanic, because it just, as much as we tried to figure out a way in which that would work, it just felt so not Python. Yeah, I mean, you can upgrade your equipment, you can get retainers and stuff like that. But when it comes to, you've achieved this quest, gained this many experience points, and now you're level 2, roll for extra, you know, harder to kill points, we're like, no, it has to be flat in that regard. I mean, you can have played a character for, 20 sessions and had all these accomplishments, and yet you're just as liable to get squashed by the Bigfoot as the lowly peasant who just joined the party last session. So all of those things led into our realization that we were going to need to come up with something new to us anyway. I don't know. I wouldn't claim that the mechanics in here are entirely new, and I'm sure there are games that have done similar things that I'm not aware of. Or if I am, I just rip them off and won't tell you about it. But but that all led into the decision. And you know, from a economic standpoint, we felt like the IP was strong enough that we didn't need to. We didn't have any pressure from the publisher or anybody to, hey, why don't you 5e this so that we can grab some more sales?
We love to see, you know, people moving away from that impulse, because it's not often the right fit.
Yeah, we've been disappointed in the past when other licensed stuff comes out and it looks like it's going to be something interesting, then all of a sudden it's like, we just slap 5e on it. I'm like, no, it wants to be something else.
I mean, I do think that there is an art to that, to adapting
for sure
a licensed IP to any kind of rules chassis. And I think 5e is a really solid rules chassis. I mean, you know, for all of the issues people have with it as a rule system and with the company and all of that stuff, it just as a system, it's fairly easy to pick up. It's pretty adaptable. And I think where people get into trouble, and this is with 5e or anything else, is when it's more of a cash grab and it's more slapping a very thin layer of paint, which is the theme, on top of the mechanics. That's when I think it can yield a kind of disappointing result. But there are a lot of things that you can do with 5e or any other rule system, I think, that can make it feel like it really is tailored to the system, and it kind of had to be that.
We've had a lot of designers on this show, but I believe this is the first time we've ever had someone who was working with licensed material. And so that's just a world that I'm entirely unfamiliar with. And so I'd love to learn more about kind of how you got into starting this particular project, and also how you approach a licensed project from the creative side that may be different from creating something whole cloth.
Let's see. This can be a long answer or an extremely long answer.
Let's start with long.
We love them. Let's start with long.
So going back several years, I had an idea for a licensed RPG, and it was with a band, a really famous band. And I pushed this idea all the way up through the merch company, through the music label, and gotten it all the way to the band, who said, yes, let's do it. And then on its way back down the chain through the layers of onion, it died for a whole lot of reasons. It kind of fell apart, which was rough because that was a year and a half or so of chasing that license and feeling like, once the band said yes, we were like, oh my gosh, we're in. It's going to happen. But the merch company that I was working with said, look, it's not going to happen, because I was chasing it right up until the final hour. Well, what if we did this? Finally, they just have to say, all right, just stop. Email that. It's not going to happen. But here's our roster. If there's anything else on here that you're interested in, let us know, and we can talk about that instead. And it felt at the time like kind of a way to just kind of shut me up and get me to stop chasing him about it. And but I looked on it. It may have well been have been in good faith, and they really were interested, but it felt kind of like a, dude, just stop. It's not going to happen, but here's the... But anyway, I looked on the roster, and there was Python sitting there alongside all these other... I mean, there were bands. There weren't a lot of comedy acts or things like that, and there was Python. I went, oh my gosh. I said, well, yeah, I'm sure would like to do that. And they said, oh yeah, actually, that'd be a good one. They're looking for stuff to do. They're looking for ways to get the IP out, especially to younger audiences, because in a lot of places, well, I guess among a lot of demographics, it's known only for Holy Grail, if anybody knows them. And in a lot of cases, it's known only as, it's that thing my dad watches, my granddad watches, you know. So they said, yeah, should be doable. So this is my brother and I, put together a proposal and sent it on, and was well received, and then we brought on, went looking for a publisher, and Exalted Funeral was super keen, and went from there. Although that in itself took about 18 months probably to go from those initial conversations to signing the contract, because there were a lot of conversations where and meetings and PowerPoints, if you can believe it, of me explaining what an RPG is. You know, I mean, just a lot of people saying, wait, what is this? What do you propose to do? So there's a lot of explanation and when it came to management, a lot of trust that had to be earned in terms of whether we really knew the IP and whether we were going to take care of it in the way that they wanted us to. Python's manager is Holly Gilliam, Terry Gilliam's daughter. And she's kind of the gatekeeper of all things Python. And she is very invested in making sure that their legacy is preserved and carried on, and they still approve stuff and all, but she was the contact at management. Even then, it was very, very up and down. It was a roller coaster where it sounded like, yeah, this is going to happen. And then things would go quiet, and then it would come back and seem like, you know, it was a new person in charge on the merch company's end. And so now it's resurrected, and then it would die again. And it got to the point where I had to resign myself. I remember talking to Matt at Exalted Funeral, and we just kind of had to say, you know, we might have to move on. This is, I'm not sure this is going to happen. And so that's when we signed the Dr. Rodbort contract. We'd been talking to the guys at Weta Workshop, and that came together very quickly, and they were really excited to do it. So we signed that contract. I'm like, okay, we're doing Dr. G. And then almost immediately, Python came back, and we signed that contract too. And I was thinking, oh my gosh, I'm not going to say no to Python, but we just signed this other one. So I just had to kind of buckle up for what was going to be a 2 years where I didn't really see the sun, because those two were really developed simultaneously, and won't ever do that again. But once we got through all of that stuff, working with the licensor, working with Python management, it was great. Holly's very enthusiastic about it and very just really supportive and willing to give us enough leash to do what we needed to do in terms of altering characters and creating some new ideas that wouldn't violate canon in a way that allowed us to make it the way we wanted to. And you don't always get that with a licensor. You don't really know if it's going to be somebody that's going to say no to almost everything, and you're left with very little you can build on. But she was not like that. She was great the whole way through and allowed us to make it the way we wanted to. And hopefully everybody else will like it too. I think she likes what we ended up with. We like it. And now the real test is when it goes out in the world.
And kind of, I guess, speaking of those, like, you know, the next people who are going to see it, these people who are going to, you know, play the game and absorb it, one of the things we really wanted to get into was, like, some of those people will be Python diehards like yourself, and then some people will have maybe seen Holy Grail, maybe not seen anything. And when you were kind of designing the game, how did you sort of balance those two kinds of people and everybody in between?
Our goal was to strike that balance. Whether or not we did it, I guess, remains to be seen. But at least in the playtesting I've done, I've had people at the table who were kind of on both ends of the spectrum at the same table, which was kind of ideal. That's what I wanted. And even at PAX Unplugged, I had tables where there were people who knew every line and those who said, oh yeah, I don't really know anything about Python, but my friend said this would be fun. And I found in those sort of limited sample size that those who didn't know it were still felt like they got the vibe. And that's the main thing. I mean, it wasn't for us, this isn't about playing the greatest hits and, you know, recreating existing scenes, you know, do like, okay, guys, it's time for us to all do the Black Knight scene. Yay, everybody do the line. It's really more about capturing that weird, surrealistic, subversive, I mean, humorous vibe that makes Python feel the way it does. And I think going through the character creation process, kind of does that. It introduces you to the kind of mindset that the game has, and people were able to kind of get that, I think, pretty quickly, to just when they saw the kind of equipment that they were being issued as part of the character creation process and some of the choices they were making. They weren't choosing between, you know, playing Cardinal Jimenez or Timmy Williams. You know, they weren't making those kind of choices where they had no context about who is this guy. It was more about, okay, I'm a knight. What weapon do I have? Roll in the chart, and I have, my weapon is knightly fresh fruit. What does that mean? And you just kind of nod and say, yes, that's exactly right. You're armed with fruit. And you know, people, that sort of weird surrealism, even if you don't know Python, I think is pretty universal. People kind of get like, oh, okay, we're in some weird place now. So I think that there's plenty of Easter eggs and plenty of things that will be recognizable if you know Python, but the idea was to make sure that it's accessible to those who are gamers but don't know Python. And you know, to be fair, management from the very beginning was never interested in and would not have allowed us, I think, to make a game that was recreating popular scenes. And that was one of their first concerns. Like, say, wait, what does this mean, that somebody's going to be playing Arthur and somebody's playing Zoot? Like, they're recreating and so explaining to them, no, you're making your own characters. You may encounter them, but you're not sort of going on the Holy Grail quest the way that they did. And they weren't interested in that. And fortunately, neither were we. That was never the game that we set out to make.
I think reading through the Monty Python Quick Start and reading through some of the PDF of the core book, I've had this perception for a long time that anytime I see like a licensed game, it always feels very limited to me. Like, I've never had much of an interest of like playing as Spike Spiegel in a Cowboy Bebop, you know, RPG. But one of my favorite role-playing games is Orbital Blues, which is, you know, basically kind of Sad Space Cowboys, Cowboy Bebop. It's interesting to me how much I was wrong in my perception of how I felt about licensed games when I read this game, because it does feel very much like you're getting a lot of the vibe of Python. Like, the reason people come back to Python is like, I want to live in this headspace. And this game really gives you a lot of that, like, hey, let's play around in that type of world, but not necessarily in that world in a way that I really enjoyed when I was reading through it.
Yeah, so the other ones that you mentioned, Orbital Blues, I mean, what is it that was different that you liked about that?
I think it's that it gives you the vibe. It puts you in the space of that world, but doesn't say, like, you have to be beholden to this. And that was always the thing that, like, it didn't quite click with me. Like, I didn't think I'd enjoy it. And I, you know, I haven't played the Cowboy Bebop role-playing game. I haven't played any, I'm trying to think through, I haven't played any of the, like, directly licensed games. And that's always been the hang-up in my head. But after reading this, I'm kind of reevaluating it in my own head of, like, wait a minute, maybe I'm being a little bit too narrow in my thinking on this.
That's exactly our mindset too, going into this, is that for us, the fascinating thing about Python, the reason we have enjoyed it for as long as we have, is that it's its own world. It's hard to even say world, because there's many worlds.
It's close, but, like that. Yeah, it's when you watch Python, you are going into a certain type of space. It is a universe unto itself.
Yeah, it's a weird mindset. I remember, I think it was Terry Jones said that the fact that Python-esque is in the dictionary is a testament to how thoroughly they failed, you know, because they, more than anything, they wanted to be undefinable. I don't know about more than anything, but that was at least when he gave that interview, Terry's opinion was that they didn't want to be definable in any way. They didn't want to be categorizable in any sort of way. And yet somehow they managed to create their own category, and now other things have that adjective applied to them. But I think that there's enough that is unique about Python that it does feel like there is some kind of weird surrealistic glue holding it all together. And that was what we were hoping to capture. And also why it's not Monty Python and the Holy Grail role-playing game. You know, we didn't want to be limited to just medieval England and the Holy Grail, and management wasn't interested in that either. We set it in medieval England because the conceit of the game is that it's not a game at all. It's about teaching British history, in particular medieval history. So the backdrop is medieval England, but all of their work has been plumbed in various ways, not just in terms of who is in the world, but in terms of game mechanics and all of that. I mean, there's a lost legion of Roman soldiers wandering around in North Wales, and they don't know that the Roman Empire collapsed. So 500 years later, they're still marching around, drilling and doing their stuff. And of course, there's Life of Brian stuff, right? And in fact, one of the major religions in this game is Brianism. So the idea is that all the stuff that happened in Life of Brian, that happened. And Brianism survived, just like Christianity survived. Brianism didn't thrive in quite the same way, but there are Brianists around. You can be a Brianist if you want. But of course, then you have to choose whether you're the Order of the Gourd or the Shoe Sect or the Sandal Sect or the Juniper Bushes Sect or whatever.
I think you and I can both agree we need more Brianists in the world.
Yeah. I mean, hell, you can encounter the PFJ is still around. The People's Front of Judea, they're still around as a movement and opposing all things Roman. So that's a way that the Life of Brian gets in there. But then a lot of Flying Circus stuff gets in there too, but in a kind of fourth wall breaking way. I mean, as the head of Light Entertainment, the GM basically, you are not only interpreting rules and running the game and all of that, you're meant to take on one of 18 personae. And those personae, a lot of them are from Flying Circus. I mean, you might be Jimmy Buzzard or Cardinal Jimenez, Spanish Inquisition. You might be an upper-class twit, but you're rolling on a table at the beginning of every session to see which one of these personae is actually in charge of this program. The BBC has put this person in charge, and they're the head of Light Entertainment. And you're meant to, you don't have to act them out and use voices and all, but each of them has things that they like and dislike. And part of the kind of meta layer in the game is players are meant to be keeping an eye on what things that they do earn merits and demerits from this particular head of Light Entertainment so that they can figure out, oh gosh, Cardinal Jimenez really hates whenever we make fun of the Pope, and boy, he really likes when we do this and that. So there's an intentional, anachronistic fourth wall breaking to the game, and the anti-immersion, you know, it pulls you out of your medieval world and makes you focus on actually what's happening at the table. And it could actually pull you out of the medieval world in terms of the game. I mean, if you accrue enough demerits, then your character suffers what's called a beshrewment. And you roll on this table and find out what happens. And this is where suddenly everyone is transported to a 1970s television, BBC television studio, and you are on a television show called Crossbows and Why They're Terrible. Joining us tonight are, and you go around the table all participating in this talk show or this quiz show or blackmail call-in show or whatever it is, depending on the role. And as soon as you finish that little episode, so things switch back jarringly to medieval England. So really, I think that the experience of playing the game is probably more akin to watching or living in a Flying Circus episode, as opposed, because things just switch and shift and suddenly there's an animation and things, you know, bizarre things, anachronistic things happen, or the animator suddenly dies of a heart attack or whatever. Those things happen, and then things can shift very quickly, which is makes it feel, I think, different than what people expect, which is that we're just playing Holy Grail. You know, it's much more like living a Flying Circus episode than it is living the Holy Grail movie.
It is a convenient thing for a game master because a lot of Python sketches didn't really have an ending. They just kind of decided to do something else at a random time. It's nice to not have to be necessarily beholden to, like, I got to have a nice narrative ending to this in this world that you're creating. It's like, great, just move on at any random time and do something totally new. And that will be satisfying in a way.
Yeah, one of the things Cleese said, I think it was Cleese, said, they'd watch these great British sketch shows of the day. And for them, the punchline at the end that had to wrap up every sketch was the worst part of it. Like, they were so into it the whole time and the buildup and the creation of it and the increasing weirdness. But then the fact that you had to pull it all back together with a corny punchline, everybody look at the camera, roll the laugh track, switch to the next sketch, that they hated that. So they refused, they subverted that entirely and very rarely would have that punchline ending. And so some of the heads of Light Entertainment in the game support that idea. They hate when they're trying to subvert all of that. But a number of them, or at least a couple of them, are antithetical to that entire idea. They're stuffed shirt, old school kind of executives who very much want punchlines at the end of every scene. They want clean segues. They don't want things to go jarring. So if something happens in the game, either because the players make it happen or because some weird beshroomment makes it happen that ends a scene without a proper segue, that the head of Light Entertainment is actually put off by that, and you might get a demerit or whatever. So the head of Light Entertainment sensibilities might be working against what the game is trying to do, which is be weird and be unexpected.
Do you remember when you were a kid and you would find that perfect rock? The one with the exact right mix of colors, smoothed by time, that fit just so in your pocket and felt perfect in your hand? You were so excited to just come home and show your parents and tell all kinds of stories about this rock. Well, I am here to tell you about a brand new TTRPG from our friends at Deep Dark Games. A perfect rock. In A Perfect Rock, your home planet has been destroyed. You are aboard the last starship with the sole survivors of your people trying to find a new planet to call home. In this game, you'll navigate the stars, you will uncover secrets, and you will build planets from actual rocks. A Perfect Rock is an easy-to-learn, GM-less role-playing game that encourages creative play for all ages. All you need is a D6, your imagination, and yes, some rocks. So please, please check out this game. Head to deepdark.games/many-sided-rock or search for A Perfect Rock on Kickstarter. So much of Monty Python is about this tradition of sketch comedy, and RPGs and playing of RPGs is very improv focused. So I want to get a little into the weeds on, like, how did you make a game that creates an improv experience that emulates sketch comedy? Like, how did you think about getting people to the place where they are emulating this feeling of, like, not necessarily even, they're not emulating maybe the feeling of making a sketch, but kind of emulating the feeling of watching a sketch?
Well, I mean, I think to some extent, but as you said, all role-playing games are shared storytelling / sketch comedy, even if it's not comedy, there are always scenes, right? I mean, there are various kind of tentpole scenes strung together by narration by the GM, where he says, okay, so you travel down the road, blah, 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 let's get through this. But one day this happens on the road and now you're in a scene. So I think it most games are already set up for this. But one of the things you brought up when you mentioned sketch comedy, a lot of people, when they heard about this game, or people I've talked to, even at PAX and other places, said, you know, some people have said, I am just really skeptical about not this per se, but just any comedy RPG. Like, I'm just not that interested. And I have to agree wholeheartedly. Like, for me, a comedy RPG is not interesting. I can't imagine anything less comfortable and less fun than sitting around a table with people really forcing the comedy and trying to be funny, right? So we are very early on established that we weren't trying to make a comedy RPG. We were trying to make a Python RPG. And that those two things, I think, aren't synonymous. You know, Python is more than just being funny. I mean, there's also a lot of surrealism and a lot of like social commentary, a lot of just weirdness for the sake of weirdness, a lot of, and even the comedy takes on a number of different forms. There's slapstick and very lowbrow stuff, and there's also really highbrow literary references and commentary, because they were all obviously very highly educated guys. So that was an important distinction for us to make. Whenever we got to any kind of crossroads and had to think, we never asked ourselves, what would be funny here? What would be a funny thing to do? We always said, what would be the most Python thing to do here? You know, and even in the game, my advice to people when they play it is, first, don't feel like you need to be funny. But if you want to take it a step further, I actually think that the whole thing works a lot better if the players, or at the very least their avatars, their PCs, take the thing very seriously. Because when you think of Holy Grail and I mean, Brian of Nazareth and King Arthur and his knights all took themselves very seriously. Like they believed in what they were doing, and they were very earnest in what they were trying to do. They weren't, it was the people they encountered and the circumstances that were crazy, and it was their reaction to it that where, I don't know, I guess the sort of magic happens. And so I think that if you sit down with a bunch of people that really try to just yuck it up and be as chaotic and bizarre and try to do the funniest possible thing at every moment, it's kind of a hat on a hat, you know. I think it works. There are hundreds of ways that very strange, Python-esque, comedic, surrealistic things can begin to happen in the game, whether you like it or not, that you kind of don't need to force it and have your character be the silliest person in the room. Because if they're being serious and then suddenly something extremely silly happens, that to me is more interesting. And it also just takes a lot of pressure off the players. Like they, you know, just play your character, know who they are, make the decision that you think they would make, as opposed to thinking, what's the funniest thing I can do here? Or, geez, I wish I had a zinger here, you know? And one of the things that I think Gilliam said when people commented on how good the movies looked, I mean, the sets for Grail and Life of Brian in particular, I mean, they're amazing. I've heard some Arthurian scholars call Holy Grail the most realistic Arthurian movie ever made, or medieval movie ever made. Because, I mean, take away the bizarre stuff, but just look at the backdrops and the way people lived and all of that. It's really authentic, and they put a lot of time and effort into that. And Gilliam, or actually it was probably Jones, who said that was really important for them, because if silly things were happening and the sets were just made of silly cardboard behind them, it doesn't work as well, you know. But if you set all of that weird stuff against a backdrop that looks and feels very realistic, the whole thing works a lot better. And so that's kind of what we tried to do too.
You really need that contrast so things can stand out, so things can really,
yes,
pop.
Yes, exactly.
I feel like we've been talking a lot about, because we make actual play podcasts, we talk a lot about this idea of like, it's not funny to hear the performer laugh, and it's not sad to watch the performer cry. Like it's much more effective to just like have those things, have things happen within your story that then make the audience do that. Because as soon as that tension is broken by what you're giving them, then there's no tension anymore, and they lose the kind of enjoyment of the experience.
If I cry, then the audience doesn't need to. If I laugh, then the audience doesn't need to.
I love that. I'm going to steal the hell out of that when I'm teaching this game.
I'm sure I stole it from like Robin Williams.
I'm sure we stole. Yeah, got
definitely
it.
Not
so
original,
good.
Please take it.
So good. And you know, another kind of axiom that we held to that's very Python is, geez, I wish I could remember who said this. It may have been said about them, but I think one of them said this at some point, that one of the things about Python is to take silly things very seriously and treat serious things in a very silly way. And I think it speaks to that contrast that you were just mentioning, that if you treat silly things in a very silly way, something's lost there. It just doesn't work as well. You're telling the audience how they're supposed to react.
I'm curious about, I just like what you said there of like having certain axioms when you're designing this game, because I have to imagine that for licensed material, I guess it's true for anything, but specifically for something that you're licensing, you kind of have to have those North Stars that you are guiding yourself towards. I'm curious, were there any other axioms or any other like guiding lights that you had when designing this game? And also, was there anything that started to make its way into this game that you realized didn't work because it wasn't hitting that like Python-esque North Star that you were looking towards?
You know, one of the things that we, as you would expect, right away, was the research phase. We're just diving into everything. And
it's got to be some great research.
I mean, it was, you know, actually going in, I was a little worried about it because I thought, as much as this is a dream project for my brother and me, if at the end of this, Python's kind of not fun to me anymore, it'll be a net loss. Like it means too much to me. And so I was a little bit worried about that. Fortunately, that didn't happen. My wife came in the other day. I was howling at something in my office. Said, what are you watching? I was like, oh, it's just this flying circus thing. It just killed me. So it can still, thank goodness that it didn't ruin the experience of watching Python for me. Or it doesn't make me immediately go into like work mode. So the research phase was obviously just dive into everything, take notes. And what we found ourselves doing, I think as anyone would for any project like this, is to begin to boil as much as you can, boil the thing down into its essential ingredients. You know, like what is it about Python? And you start identifying those things like farce and parody and make fun of serious things, take silly things seriously, and social commentary and subversion and making fun of people who are who try hard or all that stuff. And once we were able to do that, it helped to guide things, but you can take that too far. And this is, I don't like quoting these guys often and probably misquoting, but somebody asked a question to Terry Jones, I think, about similar to that a long time ago. And he said, any joke or any kind of comedy, if you parse it too much, it's not funny anymore. That was always kind of a danger, is if we break things down too much, then I don't know, the weird alchemy that actually makes it all work when you see it or experience it in the game just isn't there. But nevertheless, we did have to identify at least what the notes are within the chord the chords that Python plays, and make sure that we were hitting those notes. And if it felt like we were going too hard on surrealism, that you know, we made sure to balance that with some good old fashioned pie in the face kind of stuff, and just try and make sure that at least all of the essential ingredients are there, and if not in equal measure, at least in a way that feels like in Python those things exist.
There's an element to this that like I want to call like real attention to, of like when you read this game, you get a sense of, you immediately get that Monty Python voice in the writing. And like, you know, we gave you a kind of a jokey hard time at the top, like you're not British. We kind of thought you might be British, but it's like, I think there is something to note there that like these things you had to follow was capturing this really specific established voice. And I'm curious, like maybe this is an advice question or how you approach this for other writers listening, but like, how did you go about capturing such a distinct voice and one that is like not native to you in a way?
Just amazing brilliance and talent, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I figured it was that. Yeah.
You know, I kind of want more people to use that answer of just like,
really good at what I do. Yeah.
And then hard stop and wait for the interview to move on.
Yeah. Next question.
Next, please. That's a valid answer and you should use it.
Well, a lot of it is, my brother he's a good bit older than me. He introduced me to Python and Dungeons and Dragons on what felt to me like the same day in the early 80s. Those two things have kind of defined our...
Good brother.
Yeah. Have kind of defined our relationship in a lot of ways for, you know, the past 40 years. And so much of our vernacular and how we talk and relate to things uses D&D and Python as just our two major references for everything. So the idea of combining those two things is something kind of literally decades in the making because we've been doing it in our mind for a long time. But he is incredibly good at capturing that tone. Craig, my brother, he's a brilliant writer and has several Python scenes just committed to memory. He can do the cheese sketch. That's not an easy one. And the cheese shop. So between the two of us, I think we were able to, it was usually me drafting stuff and him spicing it up. A good analogy in my mind is the way that Cleese and Chapman wrote together. Cleese would kind of do most of the heavy writing and Chapman would be sort of on the couch puffing on his pipe. And like when it came to the parrot sketch, that he was meant to be returning a dead dog. And then and Cleese is writing away about how this, you know, this crooked shopkeeper is making all these excuses. At some point, Chapman just removed his pipe and just said, "Should be a parrot." And there it was. And it was just like, oh God, that's brilliant. That's brilliant. Yes, it should. And off they went. So I think the way we bounce ideas back and forth were a lot like that. I would kind of write things and he would just come in with bits of brilliance that really made it sing. And he's also just an idea font. I mean, if I needed a D100 table of weird things that might be found on the wings of a sewer budgie, he'd send me 400, you know? So I think I'm more of the kind of grinded out guy and he would come in and just ice it. We also had fortunate to have just incredible editor on this. Chant Evans was incredible. Knows Python extremely well. Is British, which is helpful. Had a lot of really great input, making sure we captured that voice. And likewise, our copy editor, Ben Sumner, had a lot of great input to that regard. So I guess in short, kind of team effort there to make sure that we got it all right. And hopefully we did. We had to strike a balance there too to make sure that we weren't being so jokey that it got annoying. Because I think Craig and I both would tend to err on the side of, ooh, this is a fun way to phrase this. And Chant was really good because they'd come in and say, yeah, I think we can do without that one. because when it comes to game design, I'm very much function over form. I won't sacrifice utility on the altar of being fun to look at or being entertaining. So if it ever felt like things were getting in the way of getting information across, then I tried to keep myself from going overboard on making it entertaining to read. Because, you know, at the end of the day, they don't get this book so that we can make them laugh with our funny writing. You know, they want to get into the game and know how to play it and know where to find the information they need when they need it. So we had to make sure that was paramount. And if we could make it entertaining by including some margin comments and hopefully some funny turns of phrases, great, so that it's not a total dry read, but we had to put utility first.
I think I can safely guarantee this will not be a dry read.
I'm pretty confident I can say that.
I hope so. I mean, we had a blast writing it, but I hope we didn't go overboard. It was just hard not to because we love the material so much and just getting to play in this world. It was very easy to get carried away. I mean, at one point, I remember very, very early on when we were trying to figure out, you know, how do you even write a rule book? I mean, for a Python game. And we thought, well, it's going to be one of two things. Like, either we keep the rules extremely lean, keep the rules light and the explanations lean, or we write a 15-volume compendium and with like an entire book, completely, an entire volume is focused on just the mechanics of climbing a ladder. You know, that would have to be that annoyingly meticulous. And obviously, our publisher said, yeah, let's do the former, guys. Thanks.
Brian, so we've been talking for a long time about this game, and we haven't actually talked about the mechanics of this game because there's so much fun stuff to talk about with Python and how this game developed and stuff. But can you give us a quick primer on how this game actually works once a player dives in?
Yeah, so there are 10 character classes, but in this game, they're referred to as situations. We use the word class, but only in the sort of British social class system. You're either upper, middle, or lower class. So as a player, you choose which class or which situation and then create a character from there. And the situations themselves are fairly mundane. There's the churl, the peasant, knight, monarch, noble, troubadour, monk / nun, and the cleric, and knave. Well, I was just going to name a few, but now I'm probably close to 10. So I might have gotten most of them. But choose your character type. And then each character has 5 traits. And those traits are kind of the building blocks of your character. There are 18 possible traits, and each character type comes with a certain number of them automatically. I mean, if you're a churl, you must have animal husbandry as a trait. If you're a knight, you must have valor as a trait, and you must have chastity as a trait. And so each character then has a number of blank lines that you can fill in with a trait of your choice, although the choice is somewhat limited based on character type. In addition, some situations come with a retainer. A knight comes with a manservant, complete with coconuts to clop, which indicates that you are mechanically, you're mounted. And monarchs come with, or nobles come with a valet or a handmaiden, and you also have a choice. Oh, enchanter is one that I didn't mention. As an enchanter, you can choose a homunculus or an apprentice as a retainer. So your job when you're creating characters is just to fill in the rest of those 5 lines with either traits or retainers according to how you want to build your character. In addition, each trait comes with an accoutrement, a piece of equipment that is associated with that trait. And so when you choose a trait, you roll on a table associated with that trait to see which piece of equipment you start with. And those accoutrements can vary in terms of how silly they are. I mean, as a knight, you may start with a flail, sure, but you might also start with knightly fresh fruit. as we said, the D10 tables for each trait are they draw very heavily on Python canon in terms of the kind of stuff that you have. You might start with the Wizzo box of chocolates, or you might start with the Burlington Wallbanger or whatever. But you have one of those for each of your traits. And those come with a certain amount of flavor, a lot of them. But one thing about the traits that is different maybe from what one would expect is that those things, your starting value, the die that you roll for each of those traits is not etched in stone. So each of the traits that you have, you will assign a die from a D4 all the way up to a D20 to that trait. And that's in increments of 2. So the game comes with a D4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, and all the way up to D20. So you might start the game off with, a D16 in Wisdom and the Ways of Science, which is pretty good. It means you're rolling a 16-sided die every time you're using that particular trait, or if it's tested by some outside force. But if you roll a 1 with that die, if you spam it, as we call it, then you immediately move down a die value. So the next time you're using Wisdom Ways of Science, you're going to be rolling a D14. And if you spam that, now the next time you're on a D12, and you're so you're getting sillier in the trait as the game progresses. On the other side of the coin, if you ever max a roll, then you move up on the die continuum. So we call that struthing a roll. So your effectiveness in any given trait varies as the game progresses, depending on how your rolls go and how other choices you make are, which makes things pretty variable and keeps things moving around. It also keeps people from getting like too precious about their character builds or how good they are at any one thing, which also feels very not Python. You might be incredibly silly in hardiness, for example, but if you screws your roll, well, now you're actually kind of a little bit better at it. And likewise, if you spam a roll, then you're just getting sillier.
I love that getting better is like getting more serious. Getting better is a negative thing. It's like, no, don't hey man, don't do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. I mean, if you're on a D20, which is the biggest die you can roll for any given trait, if you roll a 20, well, that's supposed to be great. But one of the rules is that if you ever get a 20 or better on any roll, you've earned a demerit. You've taken things too seriously and made everyone uncomfortable. And likewise, when it comes to struthing, if you max a roll, then not only are you increasing the seriousness of that trait by one degree, you're also immediately rolling that next bigger die and adding it to it. So it's exploding dice mechanics. So if you're on a D14 and max that, now you're rolling a D16 and adding that to it. So chances of taking things too seriously and overdoing things a bit, you're still going to be successful in what you're doing. It's just you've also made us uncomfortable.
I love that it's kind of a direct call out of like, hey, you know how you normally play games? Like,
right.
That we don't do that here.
Yeah, that kind of subversion, you know, of and sort of undercutting of especially power gaming and min-maxing was a part. It just felt like something Python would, if Python were to make a sketch about role-playing games, they would make fun of power gamers.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
It's also really convenient for, I think, for any player, but especially for new players, of I roll a die and I immediately know, did I succeed? Did I fail? Am I serious or am I silly? And I can do a lot with, like, that's a lot of knowledge in one dice roll that all of a sudden I can really play with as someone who may or may not be comfortable role-playing.
We definitely wanted to make the die rolls and the way the traits are described, because even each of the traits has a serious or silly side to it. And
I was looking through these earlier, and they're great.
For Bardistry, if you're on the serious side, then you are either a bit, rather, quite, or a bit too Bardical. However, if you are on the silly side of it, you are either a bit, rather, quiet, or a bit too Bing Tittle Tittle Bong. Right?
Yep.
Which, in terms of describing characters, I've been at tables where players very seriously would say, in introducing their character, I am, at the moment, rather Bing Tittle Tittle Bong. And you know, just deadpan, which is beautiful. That's perfect.
Love that.
I loved seeing decorums to being decorous and fart in your general direction.
Right. Like, right.
If I've never played a role-playing game in my life, I know how to play those two sides of the coin.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's what we were aiming for, is that just in seeing that, that's what I mean by character creation. I've found is a really good way to just onboard people. It's kind of an on-ramp to not only how the game works, because the core mechanic is just trait rolls, but also just the mindset between rolling for your accoutrements and potentially getting something very strange or very silly, and seeing on your sheet that you start the game as rather fart in your general direction. It really helps people get in the right mindset.
I also have to call out that the two sides of animal husbandry are, if you're serious, animal husbandry, and if you're silly, animal husbandry, which I think is excellent.
Yeah, I know. A lot of people ask, is this a typo? Because it's the same one. I say, no, it's not.
Not at all.
I'd rather not go into it further, if you don't mind. Overall, I mean, the mechanics are pretty light. I mean, the book is 350 pages, and I think 15 of them are rules. The rest is just content. So that was, I mean, that was a a distinct choice that we were aiming for, is to make sure that it didn't feel too mechanically heavy, which didn't feel very Python-esque. And, or as I said, I mean, we either had to go way overboard with the mechanics or keep it light. And then other than that, I mean, there's just, there are kind of two ways to take damage. You can take bits of death, which is sort of physical damage, or bits of loony, which is kind of, you know, putting you on the road toward going completely coconuts. And yeah, I remind, but pretty straightforward. And then every character class, every character type has a trait that they're indifferent to, which means they can't roll a die for it. So they don't really use it. Neither can they be affected by it. So knights, for example, are indifferent to subtlety. So they are themselves not subtle, right? But likewise, they're immune to it. Like if somebody tries to use subtlety to slip a couple of a drop of poison in their goblet or stab them in the back or something, they're indifferent to it. How that plays out depends on the context. I mean, they, you know, just reach for the goblet and knock it over, or they're gesticulating as they're telling a story about their heroism and knock the cup of poison over, or you know, bend over just as and to tie their sabatons just as the thief is about to stab in the back or whatever. But that's another little wrinkle in there that hopefully not only provides some mechanical interest but gives you a little bit of flavor in terms of, well, I'm indifferent to subtlety, and what can I do with that in terms of role playing.
Oh, that sounds so fun. So, Brian, you know, there's, I think probably, we didn't even get to talk about public domain imagery, but we're already hitting the hour mark. So I encourage people, if they're interested in seeing a great example of using public domain imagery, go check out this game. It's got it throughout. It's very beautifully done. But sadly, we are coming to a close, and we have one final question that we ask all of our guests. And so this is, what are you bringing to the table? And this is just our cute way of asking for a recommendation for our listener. This could be a person, a game, a show, a resource. It can be tabletop related. It can be not tabletop related. So Ryan Saliba, what are you bringing to the table?
I would recommend a role-playing game, Apollo 47 Technical Handbook. It is, to me, the most Python game that I've ever seen. It's by Tim Hutchings. And it is a 1,200-page behemoth of a book. I mean, it's not a doorstop book. It is a door. It's, I don't know, 3 or 4 pages of mechanics in terms of how to play the game. And then it's over 1,000 pages of actual NASA technical readouts and documents that for you as a player just serve as reference points when you basically, players go around the table and communicate with each other via radio and report on the missions that they're doing. There are no die rolls or none of that. It's just, and the idea is that everyone else is sort of plumbing these 1,000 pages of technical printouts from NASA and using that to complicate their mission or just engage in an unbelievable technical pedantry. And it's I mean, the book is, for me, it's just I bought it knowing I'd never play it. I just, something said, I want that in my life, you know, that idea. And as an artistic statement and the commitment to the bit, I think is what really got me to it. You know, it's just, it's so committed to what it is that, how many people must have told him, like, dude, just like make it 400 pages, you know, like it's fine. You'll save so much money. And he said, nope, 1,200 pages and it's $60. And he must have been told he's crazy a million times, but he was committed to the bit. And I love that. I have so much respect for the commitment to it. And I mean, the vision for it is brilliant in its own right, but to follow it through with that level of determination is to me, like, just something I aspire to.
Love that.
Tim Hutchings truly does it like no one else.
And we'll put that link in the show notes as well. Brian, we're going to move to an outro. Is there anything else you wanted to cover before we do an outro for the episode?
Well, I was going to get into how you win the game, but I guess we're out of time.
Sorry, what was that?
Thank you, Brian, for coming to the table. Do you want to let people know where they can find you on the internet if they're looking for you?
Yeah, my company is Crowbar Creative. My website is Crowbar without the vowels, so crwbr.com. Crowbar Creative on the socials. And the book is the whole program, which is the book and the dice and a GM screen with interchangeable heads and a whole backgammon-based mini game called Fetch a Lavash that we didn't get into, but that's a whole other thing. Anyway, lots of bits and bobs. You can have coconut dice rollers and merit demerit tokens and meeples. There's a whole range of products. All that is available at exaltedfuneral.com. You can pre-order it now. It should be out in stores early 2025. So, but yeah, thank you, Elliot, Brian. Thanks for having me. Enjoyed the chat.
Yeah, it was a blast.
Yeah, it was so much fun. And if you're looking for more gaming content from us, you can check out the Many-Sided newsletter, or you can talk about this episode and all our other episodes in the Many-Sided Media Discord. Both those are linked in our show notes below. And if you want to support this show, Talk at the Table, you can become a member of the Many-Sided Media Patreon. Rate, review, and follow Talk at the Table wherever you get your podcasts. And that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.